time to avoid major damage. He clambers out of the bed in his underwear, trying to get his clothes on as Nell desperately chases him on her knees, trying to land a punch. He dances out of the way of her fists, and she's still on the floor chasing him on her knees, while Footlocker apologizes and tries to explain. She resorts to throwing random trash at his head, finally making contact when she lobs the empty plastic gas can. "Why do you even have that?" he asks, rubbing the spot on his head where it hit him. He's still without pants and is in his Footlocker jersey. "My car broke down, and I was going to get some gas to put in it to see if that fixed it, but I'm tired, and it was raining, so I just left it in the middle of the street." They have a discussion about how she hadn't come home the night before, hence delivering pizzas in a party dress, and how he's done having fun and wants to settle down with someone else. He puts his pants on and wishes her well, saying, "Don't stalk me," as he puts on his coat. Right before he goes, he hands her an envelope and says, "This was posted on your door earlier." Footlocker leaves, and Nell turns the envelope over in her lap to reveal to the camera an eviction notice. She pulls a wad of folded bills from her bra, mostly ones, and counts them. Then she reaches for the pizza box. Next scene. It's morning, and Nell is sitting at her desk in pajamas, coffee cup in hand. She's wearing a headset with a microphone that is covered in duct tape and is frantically fiddling with wires and clicking the computer mouse. She introduces her radio personality, explains how listeners can either call in or email their questions for her to answer, and also gives them a PayPal address to which they can send donations. There's a sticky note taped to her computer monitor that says, "Total donation so far, $37.52. On the desk is a legal pad with a long list of bills and expenses, a small pile of crumpled money on top of it. We hear her first caller begin to cry and explain her dilemma, and then suddenly the equipment goes out. Nell scrambles and frantically unplugs a bunch of cords and wires while muttering curses and griping about how she needs an IT person to help with her show. And by the time she gets everything up and running again, her time is up, and she has to apologize and beg the audience to tune in next week. Next scene. Later that day, dressed in the same pajamas, Nell is sitting in a coffee shop with a laptop and a pile of mail. Her friend Calvin glides in, impeccably dressed, and joins her at the table after charming the barista and several female customers. "Is this a housewarming?" he asks, motioning to all the stuff she has piled on the table. "Sort of," Nell replies, then shows him the eviction notice. Calvin is a banker, and he starts in on Nell with a complicated lecture about mutual funds and retirement plans and how she's too old to be living her life this way. After going through bills and bank statements, they figure out that she is $15,000 in debt and has $90 cash, $50 in the bank, plus the $37.52 in donations. Nell asks if she can live in Calvin's guest room, and he scoffs and says absolutely not. One, because she's a slob, and two, because she would get in the way of his dating action. Crestfallen, she tearfully explains that she doesn't have anywhere to go, and Calvin has a pitying look on his face that makes it seem like he's changing his mind about letting her move in. "I'm going to help you," he says earnestly, and she looks up hopefully as he gets up to jog across the coffee shop and grab one of the free weekly papers on the other side of the room. He sets it down in front of her and opens to a page of rooms for rent listings. "I'll pay for the first month," he offers, peeling hundreds off a roll of them that he pulls from inside his blazer. "And use the rest to hire some college kids to move all your shit. I threw my fucking back out last time, 4 months ago." Calvin excuses himself to go hit on the barista in earnest, and Nell pulls out a marker and starts circling ads and dialing numbers on her cell phone. The first number is a sex chat line, and at first she recoils in horror, but then after a couple of seconds starts simulating sex with the person on the other end of the phone, loudly. So loudly that Calvin comes over to snatch the phone away and starts making the calls himself. After mumbling into the phone for what seems like a split second, he hangs up and announces, "I found you a place to live. Finish your latte." Next scene. Calvin's sleek black luxury vehicle cruises down a very familiar-looking street. From inside the car, we see Nell staring out the passenger window with a confused look on her face. There are no crack houses in this neighborhood. Who the fuck over here needs to rent out a goddamn room? Calvin responds, "Some old guy needed to give up his man cave and is renting it out for $50 a week," and slows down as they pass Nell's car, now covered in tickets and wearing a bright yellow boot, then stops completely just beyond it. "Go see the room," he admonishes. "I'll wait here." Nell checks the address Calvin had written on a napkin. "Don't lose that. I wrote that girl's number on it," and groans as she gets out of the car, the light of recognition dawning in her eyes. She trudges up the walk and hesitates before raising her hand to knock, tapping her foot nervously. After a few awkward seconds of her turning to make faces at Calvin, who is ignoring her and texting on his phone in the car, the door opens. There stands Pizza Dude, and he looks pissed. The end. Part 2. Good food in bed. Having diarrhea all the time is the worst. Mashed potatoes that hopefully won't hurt your butthole. Gather 1 bag of yellow potatoes, 1 can of low-sodium broth, a little butter substitute like Earth Balance if your tummy can handle it, salt and pepper, dried basil. 1. Quarter the potatoes and cover them in a big pot with cold water. Bring it to a low boil and keep it going until they're fork tender. Drain. 2. Return the potato chunks to the hot pot and use a masher to smash them to whatever consistency suits you. I like mine a little lumpy, but I'm technically a garbage can, so you do what you want. Just know that unless you spend a lot of time in the gym on arm day, it's never going to be perfectly smooth. And you know what? It's fine. 3. As you stir with one hand, slowly trickle in broth with the other. There's no amount that's too much or too little. I err on the side of less liquid because I don't want it to turn to soup, but I don't want to choke on coarse potato chunks either. If you want, you can add some Earth Balance at this point, too, to make it kind of creamy and buttery. Once you've grown exhausted from constant stirring, season with salt and pepper and some basil. Easily digestible banana pancakes. You need 1 medium ripe, but not brown, banana. As a diarrhea person, I always have bananas. 1/8 of a teaspoon of baking powder, 1/4 teaspoon of vanilla extract, and 2 eggs. 1. Peel the banana and break it up in a bowl. Use a fork to thoroughly grind it up and continue mashing until the banana has the consistency of yogurt and you've worked out all the big lumps. This should yield 1/3 to 1/2 cup of mashed bananas. Add the baking powder for fluffiness and vanilla for vanilla-ness. 2. Whisk the eggs together, then pour them over the banana and stir until the eggs are completely combined. The batter is going to be pretty loose, like your bowels. 3. Heat a few spritzes of cooking spray in a frying pan. Drop a couple heaping tablespoons of batter onto the hot griddle. I hate making pancakes because they're a huge mess, and I never know when to flip the shits over without glopping it all over the stove. But with these, I just lift a corner after a couple of minutes to make sure the underside is brown, and then wiggle one of those skinny, springy spatulas under them kind of slowly, and then gently slide it off. Cook for another minute. I'm a rapid-fire grilled cheese flipper, and I typically implement that same strategy here. Once I've got a good golden color on each side, I flip constantly because the threshold between perfect and burnt beyond recognition is unpredictable, and I don't want to miss my window. So flip these a lot until they look good. 4. If I'm in the middle of a Crohn's flare-up, I don't use anything on top of these, but I'm sure they are a delicious vehicle for butter and syrup or whipped cream or peanut butter or fruit, I guess, if you're one of those health people. Rice pudding for sad butts. Ingredients: 3 cups almond milk, 1 cup white rice, uncooked. I know brown is better for you, but that fiber is painful. 1/4 cup of sugar, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1/4 teaspoon almond extract, cinnamon to taste. 1. This is criminally easy, and you can make it even when you're weak and dehydrated from shooting your brains out your asshole. Combine the almond milk and the rice in a 2 to 3 quart saucepan and bring it to a boil. 2. Reduce heat and simmer for 30 minutes with a lid on it, or a large plate if you're like me and bought pots without lids because they were cheaper, or accidentally dropped several lids on the concrete steps during your last move, until the rice is soft. Stir in the sugar, both extracts, and a pinch of cinnamon. Easy chicken soup that doesn't have that gross canned skin. Okay, so this is one of those things you make when you stop pooping liquid fire, but aren't yet ready to dive face first into a pizza. Like, celery isn't really on my list of things that process through my system without feeling like I've swallowed a box of rusty nails, so I gotta wait for a few white bread days to pass without incident before I attempt to test drive a carrot. But once I pass that first solid turd, it's on. Procure: 1 tablespoon of butter, 1/2 cup chopped onion, 1/2 cup chopped celery, 1 box chicken broth, 1 can vegetable broth, 1/2 pound of cooked chicken, chopped or picked apart, whatever works, 1.5 cups of egg noodles, 1 cup sliced carrots, 1/2 teaspoon dried basil, 1/2 teaspoon dried oregano, salt and pepper to taste. Look how simple this is. In a large pot over medium heat, melt butter. Cook onion and celery in butter for 5 minutes. Pour in the broths and stir in chicken, noodles, carrots, basil, oregano, salt, and pepper. Bring to a boil, then reduce heat and simmer 20 minutes. Pharmacy shopping list: Imodium, Pepto-Bismol, Saltines, Diet Gatorade, Tums, tropical flavor, for real, Pepcid, Pedialyte Freezer Pops, apple juice, broth, pretzels, Beano, a copy of The New Yorker and Vanity Fair, because you'll actually have time to read them on the toilet. Milk and Oreos. I fucking love white people. As a matter of fact, having grown up surrounded by their legion on the rough, tree-lined streets of Chicago's North Shore, I wasn't really even aware that I wasn't white until I was approximately 7 years old. Okay, I knew, because I never had a sunburn, whatever the fuck that is, but I didn't know. But with every politely declined camping invitation and spat-out mouthful of roasted beets, it became much clearer to me that, despite my penchant for craft beers and J. Jill knit cardigans, I am not white. It had been exceptionally difficult for me to come to terms with this shocking revelation. I don't know what the fuck Kwanzaa is. If a bitch asks me some black history shit, I'm always like, I don't fucking know, Rosa Parks? And black people are always telling me I talk white, which until recently I thought was due to my passionate defense of Christopher Guest films, but now realize is a criticism of the fact that when I say motherfucker, I pronounce the TH and the ER. I'm pretty much an expert in white people. I don't really understand lacrosse, but I do pay for a subscription to The New Yorker. The subtle differences between us, though, were the catalyst through which I became cognizant of my blackness. The stay-at-home mom who also has a nanny. The shorts in the middle of December. I don't get it, but I'm grateful for you guys. I really am. Without white people, I wouldn't know what the fuck a scone is, or that a $5,000 bicycle is a real thing. And with Valentine's Day fast approaching, I thought I would write them a love letter to prove my undying affection for their kind. Dear white people, I love you because you fucking mean well. I should clarify and say that I am referring to white people who buy North Face jackets and take their babies to yoga class, not these fucking Newport-smoking teen moms named Destiny spelled with 9 E's. Those kinds of white people are terrifying. I like farmers market white people, the ones who are always dressed like they just finished climbing K2 when all they've done all day is eat samples at Whole Foods. The ones who try to convince me that a $15 jar of organically grown, locally sourced, environmentally sustainable white peach marmalade is a worthwhile fucking purchase. I'm black, ho. Fuck Earth. Black people don't really believe in recycling. Or, for that matter, artisanal jam. If you see me put my Coke can in the recycling bin, it's because, one, someone left that shit within arm's reach of my desk, and two, a white person is watching me. Seriously, if there weren't so many white people around all the time, I would literally be standing outside with a can of hairspray, spraying that shit at the goddamn sun. Fuck being cold. The only black vegans I can think of are the ones dodging the bags of donated oatmeal raining down on them from Red Cross helicopters. But I love that about you guys. I love that you could sit down to an enormous Thanksgiving dinner and only eat the fucking green beans because a turkey with a brain the size of my toenail didn't have a happy childhood. That shit is fucking admirable. I also love you because you are still afraid of black people. Whether or not you're the type of misguided racial profiler who would lock the doors as I walk uncomfortably close to that old-ass piece of shit Volvo you're sitting in, if I raised my voice in here right now, 2/3 of you would get out your wallets and start up a collection to get me my reparations, or whatever it is colored people are always yelling about. I love that you're so fucking fancy. You don't cram yourselves into a sticky booth at IHOP to shovel $4 pancakes from a box mix down your throats. No, you stand huddled against the cold for 3 hours waiting for the hotly anticipated opening of that adorable new brunch place that serves bald eagle omelets and tiger milk pancakes with cinnamon butter. And I'm snarling at the table next to yours, sneering as you upload a snapshot of your breakfast and tap, tap, tap out a glowing Yelp review. But that's just bitter jealousy because your 3-year-old is trading mutual funds on his iPad at the table, and I only have $37 in my 401k. I love you because you love me. If white guilt were tangible currency, I'd be in the 1%. I'm sure it's because in your minds I fill the role of the minimally threatening sidekick or the sassy black maid white people have been conditioned by cartoons and television sitcoms to yearn for your entire lives. I am that childhood dream actualized. The Tootie to your Blair. The Alfonso to your Ricky. The broom-wielding thick brown ankles to your mischievous mouse-chasing house cat. You love that I can teach you things about black culture and our current socio-political landscape. And I love that you have no idea that I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. I'm not Cornel West, bitch. I don't know shit about black people. I'm from the fucking suburbs. But I have an innate sense of rhythm, so I'm a total blast to take to the disco. Yet you can also relax with the knowledge that I'm not going to embarrass you at your wine and cheese party by saying pitcher when I'm referring to a photograph. I'm never going to go kayaking. I don't understand the popularity of the show Arrested Development, and I'm still not sure what Montessori means, but I love you. Let's be together forever and ever. Or at least until a white person becomes president again, and you can stop pretending to like me. Dear black people, I love you too. Sometimes I sound like a valley girl. A valley girl with a sinus infection who has taken a cheese grater to her vocal cords, but a valley girl nonetheless. Rachel says that she loves my voice and its California diction, although I'm not sure whether that is a compliment, considering that I was born in a hospital in suburban Chicagoland. And I love that most of you don't make me feel weird about my voice, even if it differs from yours. Because for some black people, it's not enough to just be black. You can't just have brown skin and kinky hair and a wide nose and big lips and a large ass. You have to talk a certain way and think a certain way and present yourself a certain way. I love you because, in case you didn't know, every third black person you meet is an unofficial scorekeeper in life's never-ending game, Are You Black Enough to Be Black? If you are black and can't remember ever having received the barometer of real blackness with which you are to measure the downness of your contemporaries, chances are you're the kind of black person who enunciates all of her T's and G's and probably has a Metallica album or two in regular rotation on her iPod. My whole early life was spent seeking out the other kind of black people. Black people who unabashedly listened to rock music and quoted Star Trek, The Next Generation, in regular conversation. Black people who were often accused of acting white, although no one could ever really explain what that meant. As a kid, I never wore blonde wigs or bleached my skin, yet every day some wielder of the black-o-meter offered his or her unsolicited assessment that the way I played kickball or foursquare or jumped rope was most decidedly the white way of doing things. I love you because black people who are uncomfortable in their own skin and with their own identities often try to control and demean other black people by challenging their blackness. It's an age-old trick. Maybe you won't notice that I'm wrong and an idiot if I deflect and put you on the defensive about your heritage. Because there is no right answer to the question of who's blacker than whom. It's an ideological pissing contest, and a fight, by the way, that the Negro light can never win. I love that as I've gotten older, there seem to be fewer and fewer of these people in my life, that all the tan and chocolate and coffee complexions in my world seem to all be working together rather than pulling each other apart. I dated a dude who called me a house nigger once because I think Tupac is kind of overrated. Oh, for real. A rational person would understand that maybe I just prefer Biggie. I love you because I grew up in the fucking suburbs, man, with lots of other black kids just like me. That's the reason I speak this way. That's the reason Faith No More is my favorite band. That's the reason I know so many goddamn people named Emily. For me, this is keeping it motherfucking real. I shaved my head because relaxing my hair was destroying my scalp. I got tattooed because they looked cool and no one was around to tell me not to. Apparently, each racial judge comes equipped with his own specific ruler by which we Uncle Toms get measured. For some, appropriate slang usage is the gauge. For others, style of hair and dress dictate the guidelines. But the kids are figuring it out. I was on the South Side a few weeks ago and saw a black kid on a skateboard wearing purple skinny jeans with his hair locked. I'm never going to eat hot sauce. I hate going to all-day black gospel church service, and I will never understand the appeal of 2 pounds of yakki affixed to an otherwise beautiful head of curly black hair, but I love you. Let's be together forever and ever. Now let's go fuck some shit up while we still have this African president who will hopefully pardon our black asses if we ever get caught. Black Beauty. I was still a kid when I first figured out that I am ugly. This was in the 1980s, back when there were still real-looking people on primetime television, and magazines weren't saturated with women made of cocaine and Photoshop who set an impossible standard of unobtainable beauty. So it wasn't glaringly obvious what a hideous little beast I was. I can't imagine being a female child in this new millennium, in which half-naked celebrity ass is perfectly acceptable and readily available on the side of buses and shit. I am a slave to sugar and cheese and totally in love with this new trend of putting bacon on every goddamn thing on the menu. And I've never been shy around a plate of food. But if I was 17 years old and basically a walking open wound, and I was being bombarded by images that reinforced the idea that, as I am, I'm not good enough, I'd have a fucking eating disorder. Bulimia, probably, because anorexia requires the kind of restraint and self-control that, as evident by the thunderous clap of these thighs, I am obviously lacking. We were pretty poor, and most of our food came from boxes and cans. I should specify, before your minds start to fill with television images of the barred windows and chain-link fences meant to contain overpopulated housing project developments, teeming with children whose only option is potato chips for breakfast, that I grew up in a really nice suburb. We had art in school, and music, a swimming pool, fucking tennis courts. My mother had a college education, but she was severely disabled, and the two of us lived on less than $800 a month in government aid. When survival is your imperative, what you look like while doing so becomes of increasingly diminishing importance. Samantha is ugly and smells like pee was the reason some kid gave for not wanting to be spelling partners with me one afternoon. Now, I'm not so arrogant that I won't entertain an opinion contrary to my own, and considering my Salvation Army clothing and overall disheveled appearance, I conceded that the kid might have a goddamn point. I was ugly. I could never find pants that fit me at Kids R Us. And I probably did smell like pee. It was true, and it didn't bother me all that much. I mean, it sort of did, because we are reminded from birth that girls are supposed to be pretty and delicate. But I came to terms with my ugliness relatively quickly. I knew that if I was ever to be rescued from a goddamn tower, Prince Charming better have done some motherfucking push-ups beforehand. Being ugly affords you a unique sort of freedom, and as I progressed through school, I became more comfortable with how effortless some aspects of life are when you aren't considered physically attractive. Eating whatever you want is fucking amazing. So is being able to shave your head at 16 because you're goddamn sick of curling irons. You can be a jerky smartass without having to worry about offending someone who might otherwise want to stick his dick in you. I went to school with a lot of gorgeous girls. Girls who breathlessly recounted their first kisses and first blowjobs and first sexual experiences to me between classes. It stung, for sure, because the potential sexual interest of post-pubescent young men is the currency of female youth. And to never have been kissed as a junior in high school was fucking devastating. But beauty is this fixed thing, at least conventionally, and either your face and body are constructed in a way that fits those parameters, or they aren't. It's pretty clear whether you are or are not beautiful, and the availability of your Friday nights are an indicator that will clear up any confusion. When you decidedly are not, there isn't much you can do to change it, unless magic is a real thing. And don't get me wrong, I wasn't some soulless cyborg who was immune to the fact that I spent entire weekends in my room listening to Tori Amos and reading. But once I'd drawn the conclusion that the face and body I was born with were the reason why I had so much extra study time, I tried to stop feeling so bad about it. Because really, what can you do? I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease when I was 25, which, as autoimmune diseases go, is one of the least glamorous of the bunch. It has ruined my joints and causes me to have diarrhea all the fucking time. And I'm not sure if there is anything less beautiful than a woman with a jammed up colon limping along 10 feet behind you while shitting an adult diaper. I'm not such an asshole that I don't at least attempt to tuck it in and wrap it up and slap a pretty bow on it. Even as hopeless as my physical situation might sometimes be, right now I have a little BB cream on to even out my complexion and a Spanx stretched from my ass to right up under my goddamn bra. Because it seems too sad to just not give a total shit. I'm not sure that there is a time that I really feel beautiful. I still have the same face, the same lazy eye that is a dead giveaway when I'm tired, the same skin beard, the same weird dark spots and unexpected patches of hair. At 32, I still haven't matured enough to not enjoy the validation of someone wanting to get naked in my bed. If I somehow can club a decent-looking dude over the head and drag him back to my apartment, I still don't feel particularly beautiful. Proud of myself? Yes. Irritated that I still kind of feel like shit and that this dude who could have given me chlamydia hasn't solved a single one of my problems? Absolutely. But I do always feel smart and funny and brave. A couple of weeks ago, Jill and I went to a dating class. It was held at the Discovery Center, a learning annex home to educational courses such as, but not limited to, classic French cooking, past life regression, bartending certification, and sensual chair dance. A class was listed in its fall catalog that seemed too goddamn amazing to pass up. Black Women's Dating Boot Camp. A dating guide for women who want to find their groove. From the description offered on the website. As the roles of men and women evolve, it becomes harder and harder for black men and black women to define their needs, desires, and to find a committed, caring relationship with each other. In this seminar, you will learn how to successfully determine your personal relationship style and that of the perfect man for you. In addition, you will discover a method to beat the odds against black women finding dates, mates, and marriage. This class is for Afro-American women who want to find their one great date, mate, or marriage partner. Despite the use of the outdated term Afro-American, where are we again? 1978? My vagina swelled with romantic possibility. It was promised that we would discover the three essential ingredients for a perfect relationship. Learn how slavery, race, and religion impact dating. And learn why the smart ones love the one they're with, among other important things. And all within 2.5 miraculous hours. And all for the low, low price of $40 plus material fees. So I could be an asshole and say that I signed up solely for the joke of the whole thing. Because, let's face it, expecting to figure out why I haven't yet found my groove after 2.5 hours with a strange woman to whom I am totally going to lie when faced with any uncomfortable questions that might lend some insight into why I'm perpetually single is kind of a joke. But there is a part of me, a big part, a significant part that was really hoping to gain, dare I say it, some insight. Because my bitch-ass friends lie to me. Yes, they do. And don't feel bad for me, because your bitch-ass friends lie to you, too. It isn't intentional or necessarily malicious. It's just fucking reflexive. They totally mean well. Example. Sam. I'm too fucking fat for this tight, shiny shirt. Ugh. Struggles to remove self from said tiny blouse while stumbling out of dressing room and away from the glare of its unflattering full-length mirrors. Sam's bitch-ass lying whore friend, without looking up from her iPod and or cell phone and or Kindle. No, you are not, girl. You are the most beautiful person I know. God damn, Sudoku is hard. Sam, fat arms stuck above head, tangled in sleeves of shiny shirt, which is now caught on bra hook and won't budge from around shoulder and keeps making little ripping noises with every attempt to blindly dislodge self from shirt she already knew was not the move, and paying for a too small shirt because it ripped in half is fucking humiliating. These doll clothes are not made for a normal body. Fuck it, I'm on a diet starting right now. Friend, flipping through magazine and or updating Facebook status and or intently reapplying eyeliner and not paying attention to Sam at all, stop that. You're beautiful. You're perfect. And that shirt looks amazing. Sam, sliding back and forth on floor, trying to use the carpet traction to shimmy shirt overhead without one, shredding an expensive blouse, or two, starting a Class A combustible fire. Just say I'm too big for it, you idiot, and pull this fucking shirt off me. Every time I'm mourning the death of what I once believed had been a serendipitous romance, or pouting, disconsolate, because some clandestine relationship will never come to fruition, my go-to method of self-flagellation is, he doesn't love you because you are not pretty. Oh, brother. If you fixed your teeth, he'd stop seeing other people. Yes, obviously. And then I get in bed with a pile of magazines and shame myself for not having the willpower to subsist on steamed broccoli and lemon water alone. Thumbing through pages of cute shit from sizes small to extra, extra small, I wonder why I haven't yet invested in an assistant whose job it is to follow me around with professional lighting, and an IV fluid bag because, seriously, I could stand to do a better job of properly hydrating. The dating class was held at 7 p.m. on a Friday, perfect for lonely, downtrodden women who wouldn't be otherwise occupied or out on a date with an actual human male. I had my friend Kathleen's car and drove into the city after work, getting there 25 minutes early, which is a lifetime in a tiny fucking Honda. Instead of going in and making myself comfortable in the seat farthest back and closest to the door, I decided to sit across the street, steaming up the car and texting in the dark like a creep. I figured I could watch my new sister friends as they approached the building, size them up, assessing whether their outfits were cuter than the one that had taken me 2 whole minutes to put together. Here's what I was expecting. A warm and wise black woman, firm but fair like Oprah, possibly wearing a head wrap and large ethnic jewelry. No, definitely wearing a head wrap with a dreadlock or two poking out. And giant turquoise rings. Maybe something with an African print? And she was totally going to smell like sandalwood oil and incense. This was a woman who carried her babies close to her breast in a cloth sling, people. A woman who made her own yogurt. I anticipated making a dozen new best friends, empowered black women who, oops, I mean Afro-American women, who had bonded over our mutual dissatisfaction with the state of modern romance and commiserated over the surprising lack of beauty products for black women with natural hair to be found in major retail stores. The day before my senior year of high school started, I asked my sister Carol to shave off all my hair. Up to that point, the trajectory of my hair journey mirrored that of most black girls. Baby hair in little poofs or braids, hot combs and curling irons when I learned how not to squirm in the stylist chair, chemical relaxers as soon as I was of age. I was not offered a choice in the matter. Besides, it was the 1980s, and that is just what you did back then. And I was not born to the kind of woman who wore cowrie shells and bantu knots. Grace Irby straightened her hair and dyed it a brazen red not found in nature. She smoked cigarettes, used Olay, shaved off her eyebrows, only to pencil in new ones that were a closer match to her bottled hair color, and wore red lipstick every minute she was awake. A child of the 40s, this was most certainly not a woman who was going to allow her young daughter to walk around sporting coarse, virgin hair. When we didn't have money for the beauty shop, which was often, I spent my Sunday evenings slumped over in a hardback kitchen chair, pinning my ears forward while my mom heated those skinny metal combs over the burner of the stove. I can still hear that sizzle, and I still remember the entire routine. Hair washed with sulfur 8, conditioned with cream of nature, remember that shit? With the plastic cap and hair dryer, rinsed in the sink, blown dry over the course of an hour because that raggedy handheld dryer with the comb attachment kept blowing a goddamn fuse. I would watch TV while parting my hair to oil my scalp with TCB, grease up my ears and hairline to protect against burns, suffer through the indignity of the hot comb, then carefully roll it all up, cover it with a satin cap, and try to get an hour or two of sleep while half sitting up, because lying on those curlers was fucking painful. Then doze off during class the next day, because my pretty hair kept me up all goddamn night. In middle school, I got a relaxer. I spent a lot of time both tucking my long, straight hair behind my ears, like the white girls I was attempting to emulate, and inconspicuously peeling scabs from the chemical burns I'd received as a party favor from my scalp. I haven't had a perm in almost 17 years, yet I can still smell it in my brain. The fire that blooms inside your nostrils as the first prickle of painful heat kicks up at the nape of your neck. The first one I ever got was done at home, and I sat gripping the relaxer box as my head exploded in pain, eyes blinking away tears and fixated on the soft, bone-straight hair of the woman on the dark and lovely box. I was ashamed that my sister had to buy the super strength for the coarsest hair, but I had been promised long, fine hair that would actually blow in the wind, and all I had to do to get it was sit real still and not touch my head for 20 minutes, even though it felt like it was being burned with a blowtorch. Because my hair wouldn't be beautiful until it looked like it was really my hair. The only real experience I'd had with a black woman wearing her hair naturally was with my 7th grade guidance counselor. And even though she bucked convention with her tiny afro and loud outfits, which appealed to my ingrained rebellious streak, I wasn't convinced that it was a look I could pull off. And I didn't want to, because everyone always said shit like, "Where's she from? Africa?" As if being from Africa was the worst possible thing. And to kids whose biggest crises arose from not having the right Eddie Bauer book bag, it totally was. But something in me shifted before that last year of school. My hair never looked right, and I couldn't afford to maintain it anyway, so I just shaved it all off. I'm lucky that I have a decently shaped head. But that was in 1996, when there still weren't a shitload of black girls walking around without hair. And the internet was this nascent little thing, not the wealth of information full of tips on how to use apple cider vinegar and articles on co-washing it is today. I wasn't scorned. I wasn't drawn and quartered in the center of town. But I was also 16, and people dismissed it as teenage angst manifested. A phase and all that. I'm lazy, and long hair is for people with patience and energy. If I leave it alone for a few months, these beautiful, tightly coiled springs sprout from my skull, and everyone loves them, but even that gets to be too much. So, by default, I'm a part of this movement whether I want to be or not. In my dream life, there is this community of women who understand what it means to be a 4C and own diffusers, and we get together and talk about the virtues of coconut oil or whatever. And I'd hope to meet some of these women in this stupid class. Here is what I got. Well, what happens to a dream deferred? I sat outside the Discovery Center, watching groups of tiny Linkin Park Trixies in fitted black pants skitter down the sidewalk, huddled together against the cold on their way to one of the neighboring bars. No brightly colored headscarves. No neatly plaited Senegalese twists. No luminous brown skin. Jill, who is white and who agreed to take the class for anthropological purposes, and because I strong-armed her into it, arrived, and we entered the building to find that we were the only two people who'd signed up for the class. The only two people in a motherfucking dating boot camp for black women, one of whom is Caucasian, and the other who might as well be. I have a lot of Dave Matthews on my iPod. The syllabus was hardly what I'd been expecting. Instead of spending 2 hours focusing on rebuilding black families and improving interpersonal relationships between black men and women, or whatever fruity hippie pipe dreams I'd been so gassed up about, Jill and I basically sat through a lecture that should have been titled, How to Catch and Trap a White Man. P.S. Don't have sex with any man before you get 90 days worth of expensive dinners and free cocktails out of him. And maybe a concert or a play. Our instructor was nice enough, but flipping through the packet of information she gave us filled me with dread. I wasn't going to learn anything about myself and why my relationships fail so miserably, but she did intend to teach me how to deny my natural loudness and progressive thoughts in favor of adopting the role of a complacent mute in order to impress, not threaten, my ideal mate. But we're talking about beauty, not my need to assert myself and why I should try to repress that urge around successful men whom I might hope to ensnare in my demure lady trap. Buried deep into the photocopied pages, this is what my $10 paid for, was a sheet that she somehow skipped during our 2.5 hour intensive session. Beauty tips. Oh, of course. The highlights. 1. Dress sexy, not sleazy. What does this mean, like, in practice? No lingerie outdoors? No lucite heels at the dinner table? I feel like this is a thing we hear all the time, but it doesn't have any real meaning. Okay, I kind of know what she's saying. Don't wear a dress that shows your pussy hole. But come on. One man's ceiling is another man's floor. It's hella confusing. I choose to avoid this conundrum altogether, mostly by dressing like a teenage boy. 2. Show off 2 out of 4 body parts, but not all 4. What the fuck, bitch? To what 4 body parts are you referring? Because unless you are listing each leg and each breast individually, do you really expect a woman not to show her left arm on a date? 3. Dress youthfully, but not too young. Again, where is the line and who gets to draw it? Also, I'm pretty sure this 40-plus-year-old woman might have been wearing those low-slung sweatpants with words across the butt. 90% sure. 4. Don't wear rings. Get a Nuva ring instead, maybe? 5. Be clean and well made up. Do you really have to tell women who had $50 to blow on a frivolous date in class to take a goddamn shower? P.S. I've had sex with a number of dudes who didn't notice the green shit I had scraped out of my belly button under my fingernails or the dirt on the bottom of my sandal feet. They really couldn't care less. 6. Dress in a manner that fits in with your Cubs crowd. Just ew. My cub? Seriously? I need a motherfucking bear. And if it matters to a man that your style of clothing fits in with his crowd, he is moist and he hangs out with dicks. 7. Skirts are more flattering than pants. I better perfect the art of smiling and nodding, too. Also, I should probably be somewhere washing dishes or something. 8. Men love long, shiny hair. Try to keep your hair long. Shit, I'm fucked. 9. Color your gray hair. Gray hair is aging. Double fucked. 10. Make sure your teeth are as white and straight as possible. Triple fucking fucked! I swear to God, though, if I hit the lottery or sell more than 30 copies of this goddamn book, I will seriously consider adult braces. But then I also have to quit my job because I can't spend my entire day explaining to people why a bitch who's old enough to take Prevacid every day is suddenly wearing headgear. 11. Ditch the eyeglasses. But I need them to see. Oh my God. 12. Men fall in love with their eyes. Be eye candy. I am obviously going to die alone, with short, gray hair, in a sleazy outfit that exposes my slutty right kneecap. The many varieties of hospital broth. I haven't been in the hospital with a flare-up in over a year, which is a major feat considering that at one point in my history, I was there so often the nurses knew my name and what I was there for without having to look it up and shit. I'd just walk into the ER with my overnight bag and they'd be all, let me warm up the CT scanner. Girl, you still prefer vegetable broth? Let me get your room ready. I haven't written about the charred wasteland that is my intestines enough lately, and I'm sure that's keeping most of you who know me up at night with worry. So let's talk some shit. 2013 marks the 8th year of living with this dreaded Crohn's disease. And for the first time, in a long time, I've been feeling pretty good on a regular basis. 2 summers ago, I was totally stressed the fuck out. Working all the time, not taking good enough care of myself, keeping people in my life who drove me fucking apeshit, and that stress manifested itself into one big, giant knot dead in the center of my stomach, followed by a week spent flat on my back watching Up and The Time Traveler's Wife on constant repeat while getting shot up with Dilaudid and steroids and insulin. Because although a bitch is not diabetic, too much prednisone sent your girl into diabetic shock. Holy shit. It's nearly impossible to sleep when you're in the goddamn hospital. I go to a really nice one where I get my own room and my own cable television and my very own personal assistant to help change my shitty diapers and flip my pillow over or whatever else I'm too lazy or entangled in tubes to do for myself. Anyway, it's 2 a.m. and I'm on so many drugs and have a port in my arm and I had dozed off sitting up like your granny does, and 4 nurses come crashing into my room and shake me awake because apparently I've stopped breathing and a bunch of alarms are ringing and bitches are shouting and they're yanking my gowns off, and all I could think was, how smelly is my underwear right now, while they're shooting shit into my veins and holding the oxygen mask down on my face. I fully expected to go into cardiac arrest, because I don't know if anyone's ever told them, but shaking a bitch awake at 2 a.m. in a hospital is some terrifying shit. When all the drama died down, I couldn't have cared less about my blood sugar or my inflamed intestines. I was just mad that they'd cut off a $50 goddamn bra. It pisses me off just thinking about it. One of the problems with not dying in the hospital is that real life still goes on outside those sterilized walls. The cat needed to be fed. My dry cleaning needed to be picked up. My DirecTV bill needed to be paid. I never end up in the hospital right after the one time I clean my goddamn apartment every year. And after my sister went to my apartment to rescue Helen Keller and drop her off at the kennel, she called my room and was like, are you okay? I mean, is your life okay? How could you be living like this? Listen, bitch, had I known I was going to need for anyone other than that cat to see what I do with my empty beer cans, I would have maybe taken out the recycling. Just step over the piles of laundry and magazines and get the fuck out, lest you set off any of my booby traps. I know that's how I'm going to die, surrounded by all my poor choices and bad habits. But at least if you're dead, people feel guilty about talking shit about the porn you don't even bother hiding anymore. I was there for a week, graduated from ice chips to broth with three peas in it, to broth with three peas and one noodle in it, to applesauce, to please let me the fuck out of here. This shit is costing me $10,000 a motherfucking day. On release day, everyone is extra super nice, skipping into my room with the menu that people with broken legs get to choose from and sneaking me extra apple juices. The intestinal distress menu looks something like this. A variety of unsalted broths, apple or cranberry juice, Jell-O that I never order, black coffee, and textureless oatmeal soup. Who in the hell gets to order chocolate cake and roast beef while they're in the hospital? I asked the patient care technician who stood awaiting my food order. Really? Fried chicken dinner? Who gets that shit? She smiled patiently and said, "What about a hard-boiled egg? You can have that. You want a piece of dry white toast with it?" What a tease. No, asshole. I want a double fucking cheeseburger with it. Not some goddamn piece of shit dry white toast. But I just snapped the menu shut and said, "For $70,000, I want two pieces of dry white toast." All of you people who shit normally don't know just how lucky you have it. Next time you feel like complaining about something dumb, I want you to think oatmeal soup. See how awesome your life is? That nasty little feeling right there is called perspective. In October, I vomited down the front of my sweater while talking to this woman about prescription dog food. But until then,